Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I am going to be your host. So today, we're going to be talking with Dan Rasmussen. How's it going today, Dan?
Great.
Good. We brought Dan on because there's a lot of topics here that Dan's going to be talking about that is certainly top of my mind for what's important. But Dan, maybe you could tell the listeners a little bit about your background before we get started.
Absolutely. I graduated from Harvard in 2009, interned during college at Bridgewater Associates, spent 4 years at Bain Capital Private Equity before leaving to go to Stanford for business school, where I started Verdad. We started in 2014, about $8 million under management. And we're a little over $700 million today, a few years later. So we've grown a lot. Verdad specializes in deep quantitative research into markets. From an investment perspective, we focus on small value and recently have been very focused on how to relate the macroeconomic environment to investing decisions, sort of how to think about market timing or how to think about incorporating those macro signals into making investment decisions.
Let's kind of dive right in here. So I know a lot of people use kind of this modern portfolio theory approach and use asset allocation as a way to manage risk. What are some things you've learned from kind of your experience with asset allocation?
You know, because of the way human memory works, we tend to weight recent experience more in making decisions about the present. And that's not necessarily the right approach. So let me give you a few examples, right? I think if you had lived through the 1990s, you would have said the best things to invest in are technology stocks, value doesn't work, there's not much of a need for bonds. And by the way, and commodities are a terrible investment. If you were in the 2000s, and emerging markets were also a terrible investment. So those would have been the conclusions you had based on the 1990s. In the 2000s, all those lessons would have been wrong. You know, value stocks would have dramatically outperformed. You would have made 0% return on growth and large caps. You know, tech would have been a disaster. Commodities and emerging markets surged. And if you were lucky enough to invest in gold and treasuries, you did, you know, really well during that period because you had two recessions in 01 to 03 and then 08 and 09. And then if you'd taken all those lessons from the 2000s and applied them to the 2010s, you would have been horribly prepared, right? You would have said, I'm going to go long value, long emerging markets, and long gold. And gee, what a terrible decision that would have been, because the only thing that really worked was large cap U.S. equities. And commodities were an absolute unmitigated disaster. Value was extremely painful trade for the decade. And now we're sitting here getting ready for the 2020s. And what's fresh in our mind is the experience of 2010, when the 60-40 portfolio had its highest Sharpe ratio on record, where large cap U.S. equities flourished and almost nothing else worked, where crypto and venture were some of the best performing investments you could have made. And I think what you have to stop and pause and say, how likely is that unusual set of circumstances to repeat itself over the next decade? And my view is that rather than relying on our own memory, which is so prone to bias and so prone especially to recency bias, we should study the longer term history of markets to try to discern broader truths and broader patterns, and also understand how different macroeconomic environments shape different investment outcomes. Because the macroeconomic environment we were sitting in 1999 or 2000, right, was very different from the macro environment of 2010, very different from the macro environment of 2020. And thinking about the set of things you need to be prepared for. And I think you can think about those as broadly different growth environments and different inflation environments, right? So you have the past decade was characterized by high GDP growth, high corporate earnings growth, and low inflation. In fact, you know, deflationary pressures, right? So bonds did really well, growth stocks did really well. The previous decade, the 2000s, was characterized by two big, you know, deflationary negative growth, you know, two big recessions, right? And the things that work in those environments are things like treasuries and gold. And it was also characterized by a big emerging market boom, right, which caused EM stocks and commodities to do really well. Whereas the 2010s had a, you know, series of emerging market crises and depressing results, which both hurt emerging markets and also commodities. And if you think about the longer term, right, that's just the recent decades. If you think back really far in economic history, you get to periods like the 70s, right, where you had low growth and high inflation, right? And the only thing that works in low growth and high inflation really is commodities, right? You've got to own gold, you've got to own oil. And then when you're thinking about your equity portfolio, because bonds just get crushed in that environment, when you're thinking about your equity portfolio, you have to do a lot of tactical things to make your equities get returns, right? So things like value investing or trend following, right? These overlays that are the only thing that would have made equities work over that decade, which was essentially a lost decade for the 60-40 portfolio. So my view is that there's a much broader range of economic scenarios that could happen. And investors tend to be too prepared to fight the most recent battles, the battles of the last 10 years. And what passes as wisdom in the investment community is so colored by recency bias as to mislead people into overweighting things that have outperformed recently, which tend to also be overvalued and thus tend to underperform in the future.
You know, people say that higher price leads to a higher price. There's the momentum investing that a lot of people have taken up, especially in the last decade, is, hey, we should invest in tech stocks because they're going up. And the valuations are kind of inconsequential in this environment, or so it seems. So how can people look at that and, you know, respond appropriately for asset allocation? Because you can't predict the future. So how do you kind of look at that?
Yeah. So I think there are two big things to consider here. First, let's talk about risk. Risk is an interesting concept, right? You can think about the risk of your house burning down, right? And you could say every year, my house didn't burn down, therefore the money I spent on fire insurance was a waste, right? I just shouldn't have fire insurance because my house is not burned down and it never will burn down. Or you could say, well, statistically, fire risk is roughly, you know, one out of every 10,000 homes, you know, does burn down. So I should, you know, buy fire insurance and pay for it appropriately. But knowing that there's a, you know, 9,999 out of a 10,000 chance that it's never going to burn down. And I think if you think about the biggest risks in investment markets, the two biggest risks to a portfolio are overvaluation risk and bankruptcy risk, right? On either the stock or the bond front, right? You buy a stock, but you pay too much for it. And 5 years later, it's worth 80% less than you paid because you just paid too much. Or the stock goes bankrupt and it's worth nothing. On the bond front, it's all about bankruptcy risk, right? I mean, growth risk matters a little bit, but it's all about bankruptcy risk. And those are the big two threats to your portfolio. Now, you could look over the past decade and you could say, well, gee, the more expensive set of stocks you bought over the past decade, the better you did. So it doesn't look to me like paying too much for stocks is a risk, right? Overvaluation doesn't look like a risk to me. In fact, it looks like a great way to make money. And you know, we didn't really have any big debt crises during this period that spiked up default rates. So, you know, it doesn't look like bankruptcy risk is that risky either. So maybe that guy at Archegos had a really good idea, which is to borrow a lot of money to buy really expensive stocks. And I think that you have to step back and say, well, that's a little bit like doing cocaine. You know, you can go and do cocaine, you have a great time. And then the next week you do cocaine and you have a great time again. And you say, wow, cocaine's a lot of fun. It's a hell of a drug and I'm going to keep doing it. But each time you take it, the risk of a disastrous outcome is increasing. And I think that's a little bit what buying overvalued stocks is like, right? Has it been a risk over the past decade? No, it's been a hell of a lot of fun. But that doesn't mean it's not a risk, right? And I think key to understanding risk is to know that risk manifests itself occasionally. It's not linear. It doesn't always manifest, right? Sometimes, in fact, you get rewarded for taking risk. But I think that that's perhaps the biggest risk, the single biggest risk to most investors today is overvaluation risk. Now, I think that that's, you know, one framework for thinking about it. Another framework for thinking about it is a more quantitative lens through which investment through academics, the way academics understand the way markets work. And they would use technical terms. They'd say trend and mean reversion. So markets both exhibit trends and they exhibit mean reversion. So in the short term, markets trend. So things that have been working keep working. But as those things work and work and work, they get overvalued or undervalued, and over the longer term, they mean revert. And those are two big patterns, and you can see them across virtually any asset class you look at, or even within asset classes, that you're going to see those two phenomena occurring. Now, the trend of U.S. large cap growth stocks doing really well has been a very long trend, a trend so long that some people say it's a universal truth a permanent feature of our markets. But I think that anyone with a longer term sense of history or who has studied the longer term history of markets say, don't confuse recent history with universal truth. The universal truth is that market trend in the short term and mean revert in the long term. The universal truth is that overvaluation is a risk. And I think that recent experience is going to lead you to make directly contradictory decisions relative to what is probably prudent at this point, which is to avoid overvalued stocks, to avoid the segments of the market that are most overheated, and instead to focus on other things that are undervalued, right? Right now, value stocks are quite attractive. International large cap developed stocks are quite attractive. And if you think inflation's coming, commodities have just been through a brutal, brutal sell-off over the past decade. And they're one of the only things that works in an inflationary period.
One thing I wanted to touch on. So, you look at some of the large cap tech stocks that are, they've been overvalued for a long, long, long period of time. But obviously, it depends on how you're valuing them. But, I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, the future is going to be much rosier. So why wouldn't I invest in it now? How do you look at that? I could look at some things like Amazon's a good example where, the PE was in the hundreds for years, but then you kind of look at the future and say, all right, well, the future is going to be brighter. And some people justify that. So I think one of the challenges, especially in the last 10 years, as you said, is value's been out of favor. And 10 years is a long time to be a value investor and still keep people happy.
Yes.
So how do people kind of square that, if they're trying to invest and keep their head about them?
Yeah, so I think you have to remember that, and this is one of the key principles of our approach to investing, is that investment isn't about analysis and getting your analysis right. It's about meta-analysis. It's understanding how your analysis relates to the consensus analysis that's priced into markets. For example, if you look at the 2010s for China and the 2010s for Japan, China grew much more, obviously, right? China massively massive growth during the 2010s. Japan had basically zero to negative growth. Chinese GDP per capita soared. Japanese GDP per capita stagnated. Whose equity market did better? It was break even. So you say, how could that possibly have been the case? If I'd known what was going to happen in the 2010s with China and the 2010s with Japan, how is it they would have made the same money investing in Japan's stock market and China's stock market? And the answer is that Chinese stock market was massively priced in 2010, and Japan's stock market was really cheap. And so you basically saw that the meta-analysis, it proved that the market was pretty efficient, right? Both were sort of priced for the things that ended up happening. And so you didn't make a lot of money by making a bet on one versus the other. And so if you think about the tech stocks, the large cap tech stocks, right? They've been overvalued for a long period of time in the sense that expectations, right? Because valuation is about expectations, right? So expectations have been extremely high for those stocks. And that's been expressed through valuation for a decade. Actually, you could argue that actually some of the tech stocks are pretty cheap in 2010. But let's say, the last 5 years or so, they've been really richly valued, very high expectations. Now, the issue has been that they've actually exceeded those expectations, which is a very rare phenomenon in most of human life and in most of markets, right? High expectations are meet with disappointment more often than not, and very low expectations are often meet with positive surprises. And this is something you can see in your day-to-day life and human relationships, as well as in markets. But tech stocks had a wonderful decade, right? Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft and Netflix and Google, their growth rates were astonishing, right? Actually higher than people would have predicted in 2015 or 2016, right? So they deserve those excess returns. I mean, it was an unbelievable performance for stocks so big to grow so much, right? So you step back and say that that's something like a corporate profit miracle. Then you could attribute that to network effects or technological innovation or monopoly power, right? Depending on what narrative you want to ascribe to it, or all three. But the headline is tech stocks deserve to do well in the 2010s, right? But the issue now is that they're much more expensive in 2020 than they were in 2021 than they were in 2011, 10 years ago. And you have to ask yourself, are they going to have a repeat performance, right? Is the 2020s going to be as good for these stocks? Are they going to grow corporate earnings as fast and as much as they did in the 2010s? Now, you might be tempted to say, well, of course they are, right? Like they're world beaters and they're going to continue being world beaters. But the thing about being a world beater is that it's a target on your back. And those expectations are become at some point really hard to surmount. And so I think that you step back and say the meta-analytic answer is to say, well, where are expectations low? right? What are the set of things that could easily outperform what other people around me believe? It's why we ask every applicant for a job at Burdett to answer the same question, which is, what's one thing you believe that the vast majority of your peers disagree with, right? It's a Peter Thiel's question. It's a wonderful one because it captures how you actually make money in markets, right? You don't make money by saying, China's going to grow a lot more than Japan, so let's bet on Chinese markets. You make excess return in markets by saying, what is going to grow like China that's priced like Japan? And that's where you make the big money. And I think that's why you have to step back and you have to have an understanding of history and you have to have an understanding of valuations in order to make good decisions in investing.
Yeah, I love that question too. Well, you mentioned Japan, which I think is a really important area that I'm curious on your opinion. I know that Drew Edwards from GMO wrote a great paper relatively recently on Japan's value. What do you think about Japanese value right now? Because people have been talking about it for years, and it seems like, you know, there's some potential great opportunities there, but it never really seems to take off. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that area?
Japan has been disappointing in terms of equity returns for a long time. But again, you have to understand history, right? Like, you have to go back to the 80s. And in the 1980s, Japan was to markets what China was in the 2000s, right? People said, holy smokes, you know, this economy is so growing so fast. It's so well run. Japanese CEOs are so good. And by 1989, the valuations of the Japanese stock market were just insane, right? You could actually draw an analogy between the relative valuation between the US and Japan in 1989, with Japan being extremely richly valued and the US being really cheap. And the inverse being true today, where Japan is really cheap and nobody thinks it's going anywhere. And the US, you know, people say, it's the US management style. You know, that's what's leading to all this tech innovation. And that's going to be what's going to drive returns over the next decade. But it's the tale of, you know, two bubble markets, I'd say, right? Like, Japan was the bubble of the 80s. The US has had, you know, two big periods of rising valuations in the 1990s and then again in the 2010s. And I think you step back and say, well, gee, is there an opportunity? What's the opportunity in Japan, right? Why would I bet on Japan? I'd say the first thing is that it's extraordinarily cheap. And that's a rare thing to find in today's market. It's hard to find things that are cheap on an absolute basis, cheap relative to history. So many things are so expensive with interest rates so low. Everything seems priced to perfection, but you can buy, you know, the best companies in Japan at crazily low prices, right? Yeah, Nintendo trades at like 8x EBITDA, right? It's kind of silly. And I think there are some other unique, interesting aspects of Japan that are neglected, right? So Japanese GDP per capita is really high. In fact, GDP per capita in Japan has grown pretty much the same as the US, even while Europe has stagnated. So Japan's a really rich country. It's also an export economy, right? They're pumping out semiconductors, they're pumping out autos, they're pumping out all of these things to global markets. And so to the extent that you believe in China, the rise of China, right, you should be betting on Japan because they're beneficiaries of it. And global economic growth is going to be hugely beneficial to Japan. And I think right now, Japan has suffered from two big hits, right? One is the trade wars with China, and then two is COVID. And both of those things had a really dampening effect on global trade and the global GDP growth. But if you think, okay, gee, we're going to come out of that, who's best positioned to capitalize on a, you know, global GDP recovery and a global trade recovery? It's Japan.
It's something that's been kind of puzzling me for a long period of time about Japan and why it's kind of been in the doldrums. One thing that kind of comes up also is, you had kind of alluded to this before, is I guess what we would call the kind of the moral hazard problem. Taking risk now is not really taking a risk. I mean, look what happened last year. The whole global economy shut down, and yet we ended up 10% higher on the S&P than when we started the year. And in what world is that reasonable? So, you know, it kind of brings in this moral hazard, is why wouldn't people take as much risk as possible? So how do you kind of look at that problem?
Yeah. And I think if you look at, there are a lot of statistics on this, but aggregate equity ownership is near all-time highs, right? The percent of people's portfolio that's in equities. And part of that is the sort of, there's no alternative. You know, what else am I going to put money in? Why not put it in equities, right? Bonds don't seem particularly attractive. And, you know, you also have the shift to passive, which I think has also, you know, amplified some of those liquidity dynamics. Again, I think it comes back to thinking about risk the way we talked about earlier, that just because a risk doesn't manifest itself in a bad consequence doesn't mean it's not a risk. And overvaluation is one of the great destroyers of wealth in history. Paying too much, whether you paid too much for railroads in the 1880s, or you paid, you know, too much for 3D printers in the 2010s, or eyeballs in the 1990s, or, you know, today you pay too much for electric vehicle stocks. It all ends the same. You know, you have to have a broader sense of history and a broader sense of, you know, probabilities to make good decisions in markets, because the worst thing you can do is to make decisions the same way everybody else has, which is to base your decisions on what worked in recent history, to rely on your own memory as your primary guide to what works or doesn't work in markets. It's just the wrong approach. It'll lead you to make the same errors that other people make. You know, the greatest error, right, inspired by recent memory, is the behavior you see people take in the middle of economic crises, right? If you go back, you know, one of the biggest mistakes you could have made last year was to sell in March, right? To say, oh, gee, you know, the S&P is down, you know, 20%+. Economy could be entering a great depression. I should sell all my stocks and go to cash, right? There's no greater economic investing mistake you possibly could have made at that point. And yet it was eminently sensible based on recent memory, right? You said, well, gee, I looked at March. I experienced that myself. I know what that felt like, and I don't ever want to experience that again. So I shouldn't have the same exposure to equities, and I'm going to take it down. And I think that's that type of decision-making is where you see the biggest errors get made.
But how do you manage that risk? I mean, obviously, when you think about it logically, right, the whole global economy was shut down. You could hold your nose and buy, right, and assume the Fed's going to come in and bail you out. I mean, this gets into the moral hazard problem. Is you're trying to base your judgments based on the omnipotent Fed, who's just going to take care of everything for you. So how do you kind of manage risk in that environment? Well, because we're in that environment, but generally speaking as well.
We spent a lot of time thinking about crises at Verdad, and we published actually in January and February of 2020, we published a big piece called Crisis Investing, What to Do During a Crisis. And what makes crises interesting is that there's no dispute about the definition of a crisis, right? And you 100% know when you're in one, which is unique, right? Do we really know what a bubble is? And do we know if we're in one or not, right? Both of those things are really debatable, right? It's really hard to say, are we in a bubble or not? And GMO has labeled 50 bubbles, of which 3 actually pop. You know, there's that constant joke, right, about the person that predicted 10 out of the last 3 recessions, right? There are lots of controversies around that state of the market, but it's obvious when you're in a recession, right? The front page of the Wall Street Journal is telling you about market panic, and, you know, you can define it in 10 different ways, right? The S&P is down 20, high yield spreads are over 600, you know, whatever it is, but it's obvious, right? If you work in finance, you know, you've got your grandfather calling you to ask you whether you should sell his stocks, right? I mean, it's an easily identifiable period of time. And so you can actually disaggregate those periods in retrospect and say, well, what is the right decision? You know, what should I do in a time of crisis? And one of the interesting findings about that is that things are much more predictable when you're in a crisis. So everybody says, in the middle of a crisis, you read the headlines, you talk to people, say, oh, there's so much uncertainty. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going to happen. It could be a Great Depression, or we could recover. It could be an L-shaped recovery, a K-shaped recovery, a Z-shaped, a zebra-shaped recovery. I mean, who knows, right? Everybody's debating. Everybody's talking about it. Nobody knows. But actually, from a quantitative perspective, things are actually very predictable, what to do and what works relative to a normal period like right now, where it's actually much harder, right? And you can think back, you know, were things more uncertain in January of 2020 or March of 2020? They felt more uncertain in March of 2020, but they were actually much more understandable than they were in January, when actually everybody's predictions were much more certain and confident, but much more wrong. But in March, right, and if you think broadly about recessions and crises, you know, what works in a crisis? And I think the first thing to know is that crises are driven in part by liquidity. Ben Bernanke talks about the financial accelerator. So something bad happens, and then there's a response to that that echoes through financial markets. So lenders stop lending, equity investors stop investing in equity, and those liquidity flows have a very big impact on markets. And they have a particularly big impact on the least liquid things. So small cap stocks are the least liquid types of stocks. In bonds, it's high yield bonds, which are the smallest type of bonds. across countries, emerging markets relative to, say, developed markets, and the biggest market like the US gets least affected, right? So those liquidity flows create, you know, big selling pressure, which means that things get sold at irrationally low levels because of the inelasticity of stock prices and bond prices. And so if you lean against that wind and you go and buy illiquid assets during times of crises, you earn a relatively extraordinary premium. Because as market flow back in, when the market recovers, all those same dynamics will reverse in a very dramatic fashion. And in addition, if you think about one of the great challenges to investing is about expectations, what's going to meet expectations, what's going to fail to meet expectations. Value stocks generally get hurt worse coming into recessions, right? Because they're lower quality companies, right? That are more GDP dependent. So when GDP drops 20% in a quarter, those GDP linked, you know, commodity, chemicals, producers, et cetera, see their revenues go down 20%. And that's really painful. And so their stocks sell off a lot. And they tend to be smaller and illiquid, more illiquid. So they even get penalized even further. So you have this moment where value stocks are trading at extraordinarily, unusually low prices. But what's quite interesting is that the one time that boring GDP-linked, you know, specialty chemicals companies or manufacturing companies grow faster than world beaters like Amazon or Microsoft or Google is in the period when the economy recovers, right? So if the economy dropped 20% and then recovers 20% or 30% to get back to break even, right? You see the growth rates on those cyclical, boring old value stocks, you know, their, you know, 1 year forward growth rates actually go up to 20% or 30% or 40%, depending on whether you're looking at revenue or earnings, at a time when their stock prices are at all-time lows, where they're trading at all-time low multiples. And so you have this unique period during recessions where not only does size, you know, an illiquidity payoff in a big way, but value pays off in a big way because the predictability of the expectation error, right, in the middle of a recession is so great. In the middle of a recession, everybody's saying things are going to get worse. The recent period is a good template for understanding the next 12 months, when in fact the opposite is true, where the chances of a recovery are so high that the prospects of extraordinary economic growth and earnings growth to recover back to the pre-crisis status quo is so probable as to make those expectation errors so dramatic and thus create one of the great profit opportunities in markets.
Where do you see the current bubbles? I mean, I saw Twitter, I don't really spend much time on Twitter, but I saw something somebody sent out and I thought it was brilliant, where they said, you know, there's a bubble of people seeing bubbles. And it's like just brilliant. But where do you see kind of the current bubbles right now that people should be concerned about?
We did a piece on bubbles earlier this year on our weekly research email. And what we did is we looked at the great investors, you know, people you think of as sort of the great investors, right? Your Howard Marks, your Ray Dalio, your Peter Lynch, your Warren Buffett, et cetera. And we went back and we read all their investor letters in the 1990s. And what we were looking for is, when did they first call the tech bubble? And when did they start taking action based on it? I think it was Ray Dalio or Peter Lynch. One of those guys was the first to call it a bubble. And I think they did it in 1995. Right. And I think basically you had complete consensus among that group of great investors by like the end of 1997 that the US market was in a bubble. And of course, the bubble went on for two and a half, you know, more years. Right. So you had, you know, the classic problem that they were too early. They were all right, by the way, but they were too early. And so if you look at the returns, if you had two choices, right, one is you held value stocks, just what all those people did, or the other is you held the NASDAQ. You know, by end of 1999, you know, wow, the NASDAQ was, you know, super far ahead. But by 2003, you know, the value stocks had won over the full period. So, you know, all those great investors were right, but they looked like idiots from in 1998 and 1999. And so I think I would sort of say that it's easier to know what will happen than when it will happen. It's easier to know that overvalued assets will have poor returns than it is to know when they'll have poor returns. And I can talk about what assets are the most overvalued, right? It's pretty obvious, right? It's anything tech, electric vehicle, crypto, right? That whole space is just nuts. SaaS software, et cetera. It's just off the charts expensive. You know, private equity, venture capital, same phenomenons. And those are massively overweight, those asset classes. We know what will happen, when it will happen. We don't know. So what's the right reaction to that? One reaction is just to stick with a prudent strategy over long periods of time and accept relative underperformance, right? Which is option one, right? Because this period, the period of a bubble market, is the hardest one for smart investors to deal with. It's where you see every smart manager underperform because they're not buying into the hype, and the hype is what's paying off. The other alternative, which is, you know, a more active strategy, is some form of trend following, which is you just say, as long as this thing is working, I'm going to own it. And as soon as it stops working, I'm going to sell. Now, problem is having the discipline to sell when it stops working is really, really tough. If you're doing it systematically, you're right, you can use rules, but it's hard to implement. And of course, you're trying to sell at the same time a lot of other people are. So, you know, are you too late to sell, et cetera? But I think those are the broad two options you have, right? You either stay out of it and be prudent, or you try to chase the trends with some sort of plan to get out before it blows up.
I mean, I've been reading some of the research from Horizon Kinetics, where they talk about some of these other bubbles that are, you know, that are out there. One that I know has had a lot of discussions around it has been like the active versus passive bubble. So basically the indexing versus the active investing. You know, since 2008, there's been a huge push into indexing, in large part because the managers just, they can't keep up. Stock picking is just, there's no benefit. They're not getting the alpha that they needed. So they're just closet indexers. And a lot of portfolio managers are closet indexers now. So there's this huge bubble forming in like passive investing. Are you seeing that as an issue when you talk about active versus passive investing? And if so, like, how do people look at that?
So I think there are a few things to think about in the context of passive investing, right? I'd say the first is, you know, for any given strategy that you're considering investing in, you should be thinking about a passive alternative, right? Because the fees are so much lower and the exposure is so much more efficient. Active management is hard and generating alpha is hard and rare. So if you know that you want to invest in, say, European large caps, you should certainly consider a European large cap passive index when you make that allocation, right? That should be front and center as you compare it to active approaches. And I think, you know, I don't know what percent of the time, but a pretty large percentage of the time, the passive fund is going to be the right answer because the fee difference of going to active is so big and alpha is so scarce that it's hard to overcome. Now, that's sort of in an ideal academic world, but what people actually do when they say, I'm going to switch to passive, right? Or I'm going to put my money in a passive index. Well, they don't put their money, all indices are not created equal. It turns out they don't put their money in the Europe mid-cap developed index or the, you know, Japanese small cap index or intermediate term corporate grade bond ETF, right? Like those are such marginal products. What is sort of the flagship of passive? It's really, there are two or three flagships, the S&P 500 index, the total stock market index, and the total international stock market index. And those three indices are accounting for like 80%+ of where passive equity money goes. So you have to understand that passive as a concept of saying, hey, low fee, really efficient beta exposure is great. But what's problematic is when people think of passive and they concentrate into one beta exposure, which is basically US large cap equities. And what you've seen happening, right, we've been through a period where US large cap equities did really, really well. So all of the active exposures or diversifying exposures that you could have taken, right? You sort of said, I like small caps. Well, that underperformed. I like mid caps. Well, that underperformed. I like value. Well, that underperformed. I like the international. Well, that underperformed. Oh, I thought I should own some commodities. Well, that was a disaster. I thought I should have some percentage of my money in bonds. Well, that didn't make any sense, right? So you kind of go through and you just see what people have focused on, which is the large cap US equity space and passive exposure to that space. And there's some really interesting work on the inelasticity of stock prices, which suggests that when you start to get large concentrated flows, those flows do impact market prices and market valuations. So if you just run a regression on the stock price, the multiple, the trading multiple, price to book or EV to sales of all companies in the world, and you tag them by whether they're in the US and whether they're in the S&P 500, you'll find that there's a massive premium relative to all the fundamentals, right? So you put in all the fundamentals, like what's their growth rate, what's their margin structure, what's their market cap, you know, blah, 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 right? Even controlling for everything, there's a premium just to being in the S&P 500, just to being in the United States. I look at that and say that's driven by this investor behavior. So I don't think that passive in itself is a bubble. Passive is a tool, and it's a smart and good tool that should be in every investor's toolkit in a big way. It's an important tool. But what's problematic is the way that passive as an idea has concentrated fund flows into one particular area of the market. I think it brings us back to that conversation we had earlier, where everybody is taking the lessons of the last 10 years. And they're saying, well, that's going to repeat over the next 10. And the lesson of the last 10 years was clear. You know, dump your money in an S&P 500 index fund at 2 basis points and don't listen to anything else that anyone else is telling you. Don't do anything that anyone smart says. Don't diversify. And if you are going to diversify, ask your 18-year-old son which crappy coin is the hottest thing and invest in that. But certainly don't listen to anyone intelligent. Will that have consequences over the next decade? I think it probably will if the same recipe is followed.
So you mentioned indexing. So bond indexing is a whole different animal, right? Because you've got equity passive indexing, which, you know, certainly equities are liquid. The amount of shares traded in every day is liquid enough. But bonds aren't really a liquid asset in the same way that equities are. Yet we have these ETFs that are investing in bonds, especially high yield bonds, which don't trade as frequently as maybe treasuries. Do you see any issue with that? Because you mentioned high yield bonds and, you know, earlier in our conversation. And so I'm very curious, because now the Fed is also bailing out high yield bonds, which are extremely problematic from everything I've been reading as well.
Yeah, so there's some interesting things about the bond market and passive. One of the first things to know about bonds and passive is that when it comes to investment grade bonds, the vast majority of active managers outperform. It's sort of the opposite of what you see in stocks. So if you want to make money in investment grade bonds, you know, the investment grade, the Barclays Ag that is tracked by something called like the Vanguard Total Bond Index, is actually a really low performing approach relative to what active bond managers do. Now, why is that? Well, the first thing that active bond managers do is they screen out the vast portions of really low yielding or negative yielding government debt, and they reallocate that money to stuff that yields a little bit more. And it turns out that as you go from a AAA rated bond to a AA rated bond to a single A rated bond to a BBB rated bond, returns go up, total returns go up pretty reliably, right? And yes, you get a little bit worse drawdowns, but it's almost certainly pays off, right? Because you're just taking a little bit more credit risk, and you're not just putting your portfolio in, like, you know, one year Swiss franc bonds that yield negative 2% or whatever, which is just sort of obvious isn't going to work. Now, when it comes to corporate bonds, you know, it gets even a little bit more interesting, because there's this phenomenon we call fool's yield, where returns in credit improve up until about high double B credit rating, which is the high end of the high yield index. You can think of that as sort of the fallen angel space. And then they actually go down. So even though, you know, triple C bonds have much higher yields than double B bonds, they actually have worse performance. So it's fool's yield, right? The yields are high, but the only people that think they're going to earn that yield are fools. And so it's fool's yield. And so as a consequence, right, you see a sort of really interesting phenomenon once you get into the high yield space, where the vast majority of high yield managers underperform because they tend to gravitate to the fool's yield investment. And then they get burned relative to they've just held lower yielding but higher quality fixed income. They would have actually done better. So really interesting difference between the credit fixed income world and the equity world when it comes to thinking about passive and indices.
As we get kind of close to wrapping it up here, how should people be thinking about, you know, this market going forward? Because it seems, the way you're describing it, seems like these trends are like 10-year long trends, you know, and as we obviously were in the early part of the 20s, how should people be looking at the market and, you know, just overall with their investing?
One is to be aware of the sectors that are at high risk. So to be cognizant that U.S. large cap equities are very richly valued. Knowing that, think about what your weight is to those things. And is that weight something you're comfortable with? Second is to say, well, what is attractively valued right now? Value stocks, large cap developed international stocks. And then I think you want to think about, what macro conditions am I worried about, right? Am I worried about deflation? In which case, you know, my bond allocation is going to really help me. Or am I worried about inflation, in which case I should probably be thinking about some sort of gold or commodity exposure, or a larger international weight. So if the US dollar devalues, I benefit from that international currency diversification. Now, you step back and you say, well, everything you described just sounds like exactly the opposite of what worked over the last 10 years. And I think there's some simplicity to just saying, you know, what are the big asset classes that really outperformed and are less expensive, and which ones really underperformed and thus cheap? Rebalance your portfolio into the cheap things away from the expensive things. But I think if there was one, you know, simple guideline I would have for the 2020s, it's to take into account the starting point. We're at a very different starting point in 2020 than we are in 2010. And so we should expect that the next 10 years from 2020 will follow a quite different distribution of returns than the last decade did.
So you'd mentioned inflation, deflation a few times. What are your thoughts on that? I have some pretty strong thoughts on this, but I'm curious on how you're, you know, what are you worried about? Are you worried about inflation or deflation?
The real reason you have to be worried about inflation is because the traditional assets you own, most people own, which are stocks and bonds, do really poorly when there's a stagflationary environment, right? And stagflationary environments throughout human history have happened fairly often, you know, 20, 25% of the time. So you look at the chances of that and you have to say, well, if that happens, that's going to destroy my portfolio's returns for maybe a decade. So, you know, what can I do to protect myself, right? And that's a non-zero risk. Maybe it's 20% risk, right? So what am I doing to prepare for that? Now, predicting inflation or deflation is really hard, obviously, right? And it's a big call, right, to say, inflation is going to come or deflation is going to come. And my view is, let's sidestep that big debate, right? There are smarter people than I who have much better views on whether the next decade will have a lot of inflation or a lot of deflation, what to do about it. But if we say, I know that if there is inflation, if I see it, if it starts happening, I need to know what to do. Right, I need to have a playbook, because that playbook is so different than the playbook I've experienced in the United States since 1980 that it's really unfamiliar to me. It's going to feel pretty uncomfortable as an asset allocation decision, but it's the only thing that's going to bail me out from having a lost decade like the 60s or the 70s, where my 60-40 portfolio or my 100% equity portfolio has zero or negative real return. And I think that's where people need to study history and dust off that 70s era playbook, because it's so important to consider for the purposes of diversification.
I've thought a lot about this, and it's hard to come up with a good answer. But, you know, if you look at it, something like deflation, which, you know, I've been talking about a lot for the past decade, and it's kind of come in and out. People obviously don't want to talk about it because that creates that reflexivity problem. But you look at Japan. Japan's been basically in deflation for the last, you know, 30 years. Europe, they experienced a little bit of that. But I look at both of those as examples, and I see, you know, different outcomes, right? Europe is pretty much stagnated. Japan kind of went through a crash, probably because it was overvalued, and then it stagnated. But, you know, when we went through it, we seemed to keep trucking along, and the markets seemed to keep going higher. So what are your kind of expectations for the U.S. if we have, you know, deflationary problem?
You know, you look at some of the prominent deflationists who have been really right, right? I mean, I think you look at people like Lacey Hunt or others who have just been sort of spot on of diagnosing the economic malaise we've experienced in the U.S. and diagnosing what the right problem was. And I think laying out the solution, which is, if you think we face a deflationary future, then owning long-term treasuries turns out to be a really good bet. And I think that's another thing that we need to be cognizant of, right? That there's a very important role that treasuries can play in a portfolio in the event of a deflationary spiral. In terms of what the, you know, implications of that are, right? I think of inflation and deflation as most often correlated with the growth environment, that you see deflation in negative growth periods or when growth is low, and inflation tends to be sort of an overheating phenomenon, right? That's obviously, stagflation is different, and there can be deflationary growth periods, of course, as well, like we've experienced in the US, but it's really hard to say beyond that.
Well, you also mentioned stagflation, which is something I've not heard a lot about. I've been curious because it's come up in my mind that this is probably going to potentially be an issue going forward, but certainly haven't heard the talking heads talking about it. So do you see stagflation as a potential problem going forward?
Absolutely. It's hard to evade that as a potential scenario of outcomes, right? I mean, I think we've benefited in the United States from dramatic technological improvement and from global trade, both of which have been deflationary, right? So technology has made the cost of a lot of goods cheaper, trade has made the cost of a lot of goods cheaper. And those two forces have been very powerful. And they've also been pro-growth, right? Like they've enabled, you know, technological innovation has been very good for growth, and global trade has been quite good for growth. But if you step back and say, you know, is it possible that either the conditions of global trade stagnate for some reason, right? That outsourcing as a phenomenon gets less popular. We see onshoring, we see capital controls, right? We see many of the same things that have been reactions to global political tensions in the past manifest themselves, right? Those would be inflationary. And the same is true with technological innovation, right? At some point, if our iPhones stop getting more powerful, if our laptops stop getting more powerful, or if the revolution in cloud software slows down, then those deflationary forces have trouble offsetting the inflationary forces we're seeing from global trade and from generally rising prices. So I think it's certainly a risk, and I think it's something that investors need to study and be prepared for.
As we kind of wrap up here, any final thoughts or areas that we haven't talked about you think people should really take heed to?
If there's one big lesson from this conversation or the research that we've been doing, it's to incorporate a longer term view of history into investment decision making, so as not to be fooled by recent experience and memory, but rather to understand the true distribution of probabilities, and to try to use that to discern the difference between hype and trend and universal truths of investing. It's a particularly dangerous moment for investors today, given that the most popular assets, which are, you know, U.S. large cap tech stocks, are also very, very expensive. And we have to wonder how that will play out, and whether it'll play out more similarly to the anomalous return distribution that we saw in the 2010s, or the longer term view of history, which suggests that overvalued assets come down for earth at some point.
Great. Well, Dan, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I've certainly learned a lot today, and I'm sure the listeners will as well. Where can people find more about you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at VerdadCap. I also write a weekly research email, which you can subscribe to either on my Twitter profile or on our website, www.verdadcap.com.
Let's get into the panel portion of the show. So this week we have our very own Barb Friedberg. Hey, Barb.
Hey, Kirk. I'm ready to get down in the mud with you this week.
All right. And we also have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Kirk. I don't know if I can match that passion that Barb has for getting in the mud, but okay, let's do it. I mean, this was a great interview.
I didn't want to pull a joke out from Barb's comments. I'm going to let that sit. But yeah, so I really enjoyed that. I think it was good getting Dan on the show. I think he had a lot of great, insightful information that I think the listeners are going to get from. But let's kind of dig in here, because I think there were a few things that we can touch on here that I think are worth mentioning. So, you know, there's one thing he mentioned, the Peter Thiel question, which I love. So Barb, let me ask you that question. What's the one thing you believe that your peers do not believe?
Well, I've mentioned this on the show before, and I may not have been completely transparent. So now you are going to get the true picture. I've said I like cash because it gives me a feeling of security. And I've always been a relatively conservative investor, meaning I have a smaller allocation to stocks than would make sense for someone of my net worth, or when I was younger, for my age. I also have a very large allocation to cash. And I don't know if I should say this or not, but I have at least 5 years of living expenses in cash. And many would say that's stupid because I could be earning more returns. And I agree, that is true. But I also like the security that comes from whatever happens, I can do okay financially for the next 5 years without making any kind of major changes.
So how did you kind of come up with that, Barb? Because I think for the listeners' perspective, they're probably thinking, wow, you're crazy. You got 5 years of cash. You know, what kind of brought you to that perspective as opposed to just, let's say, 1 year?
Well, first, let me put it into perspective, because this, I'm heading into retirement. Whether I retire or not, as my daughter says, you're never retiring, mother. And I don't know if I will or I won't, but I'm at that age where many people do decide to retire. And one of the biggest risks when you're entering into retirement is that your portfolio will take a big downturn at the point when you are ready to start withdrawing your cash. And that sets you up for lower returns going forward. And so, like I said, I don't know if I'm going to retire or not. But that said, if I choose to retire, I don't want to be dependent on taking money out of my investments if I don't have to. And so that's what leads me to have such a large cash position at this time in my life. This will not apply to many people, and I have not always had this large a cash allocation. But that said, during other periods of my life when I was younger, I also always had at least a year and sometimes more, because it just gives me psychological comfort. And that's a really, really personal thing. Sometimes you want to do something that makes sense for you that may not be the most prudent way to invest.
I like that perspective, Barb. I really appreciate that, because I think one of the things you mentioned was, I guess, what we would call sequence of return risk, you know, which is the risk of taking money out for, let's say, retirement at a time where it's maybe not optimal. So let me ask you the quick question before we go to Megan. What if the market dropped like 60%? Would you still have that 5 years of living expenses?
Sure, because it's in cash. So what the market does has no basis on that. And if the market dropped 60%, I would... Oh, I get what you're saying. No, I would invest some of that money in the markets if the markets drop 60%, for sure. Because part of that cash also pertains to the fact that markets are overvalued in certain pockets. And so I'm a little more cautious about putting more money into the investment market. So yeah, if the market drops 60%, I would definitely deploy a percentage of that cash into the markets.
Megan, what about you? What's the one thing you believe that your peers do not believe?
I think it's a couple things, and I don't know if they don't believe it, but when I'm managing an asset base, I am, first of all, like Barb, I like cash, but when I'm managing an asset base, I'm actually pretty bullish on real estate. So in working with wealthy people over the years, one thing I've seen is actually having a pretty nice real estate portfolio and running things as rentals and using your real estate efficiently helps build wealth. There's something about owning real estate that does help create wealth. So I think that's one thing. I think, but by the way, when I have my clients in real estate, like if we own a rental property, and this is true even with the personal properties, I don't like debt. I don't like mortgages. So I often have people pay off all their debt. And it's funny because my chief investment strategist always laughs because she's worked at a few firms and she's like, yeah, I can tell your client's balance sheet's a mile away. They never have debt. I find from a client experience, they like not having debt. And it also allows us to do things like have rental real estate that actually is cash flow positive, even if it's tax neutral. And I think the last thing is because I work with corporate executives, you know, the true portfolio construction, you're not supposed to hold a single stock position. And the truth is diversification just preserves your money at a reasonable rate of return. Owning a single stock position creates wealth. So I'm far more comfortable with my clients holding large single stock positions than I think is probably the industry norm. So nothing too exciting, Kirk. Barb had all the excitement in her answer, but what are you going to do?
I was just thinking as we were talking about this, the Alice in Wonderland quote, like I frequently think of, you know, six impossible things before breakfast. I think what you said, Megan, actually there was a really good distinction of growing wealth versus preserving it, you know, single stock position versus diversification. I think that's something a lot of people don't really think about is how the concentration can help build wealth. I'm not suggesting people do that because obviously there's a lot more risk.
Yeah, that is not an endorsement of that. That should only be done with a professional.
Please do not do this at home.
Exactly. I'm speaking in general broad terms. This is not advice.
I think it's a great perspective because I think a lot of people, they just listen to, you know, the rules of thumb, which is diversification, reduce your risk. But then you see people like, you know, Warren Buffett who say, you know, only have a few eggs in the basket, but watch that basket. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And any of the most successful investors out there will tell you the same thing. Like, they made their wealth through a handful of really concentrated positions that have done extraordinarily well. But of course, you can't tell everybody to do that, unless, of course, you're investing in meme stocks, which case you're making and losing fortunes every day. But
you know what? He said something on the call about, that relates to meme stocks. I don't know if you guys caught it. And by the way, because when I listened to this interview, I'm assuming, well, Kirk, maybe you were doing the interview, so you didn't do this. But Barb, did you write, like, take notes every time he said something that was like a really great nugget of facts?
I should have.
Well, because when Kirk's bringing up meme stocks, you know, one of the things that I wrote down is he talked about the two patterns of the markets. In the short term, we have market trends, but ultimately everything goes back to mean reversion. And I think that this is important given how people are acting in the market today. Wouldn't you both say so?
I love the reversion to the mean concept. I think it's something that isn't talked a lot about because our swings in the market have become a lot more, they've become a lot larger, frankly. And you know, if you go back and look at the early 1900s with inflation, deflation, like, one year we'd have inflation, the next year we'd have deflation. Like, it was just, there was a lot more volatility to it, and it was more normal and accepted, and things just worked. So it wasn't like the world imploded because we had deflation. It was just kind of a normal thing. If you think about reversion to the mean, you get these big overvaluations of the market like we have now. And at some point that'll change, you know, it'll swing the other way, kind of like what happened last year. But there is this kind of reversion to the mean in a lot of ways with individual stocks, with markets in general. So I love the concept. It's just not talked about enough because it doesn't happen as frequently.
This is one thing I do it a lot with client kids when I'm teaching them about the markets, but I do it occasionally with clients. I love the Cowen chart, which is, you know, that chart of historical returns. It looks like a patchwork quilt, and it ranks the best performing asset class and the worst performing asset class by year. And I always love to show that to kids when I'm teaching them about the market, because I ask them to see patterns. But what it's really showing them, and we talk about it because we always look at like emerging markets. And if you look at emerging markets, worst performing asset class in 2008, I think it was down 66%. Best performing asset class in 2009, I think it was up 78%. And the kids are always drawn to that, right? Hold on, what happened here? And I talk about it, I'm like, it's reversion of the mean. This is where you're seeing that things do sort of average out over the long term. And I think investors, it's sometimes hard to factor that into your investment because we are so caught up. And I think that on the interview, he said it, we rely more on our more short-term experiences, more so than our long-term experiences. And so I think that it's hard to see it, but I think the Cowen chart can be very helpful with people.
Let's kind of talk about this a little bit because we've kind of touched on a few things here. You know, Barb, I know you were investing in the 70s and 80s, and you know, I know Megan and I, we can look at history and we can say, all right, yeah, this is what happened here, you know, in these past years, but living it's much different than actually just reading it in a history book. So what's kind of been your experience around investing in the 70s and 80s?
Well, I actually just started investing at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s. And I remember a dinner. My family was invited. I was, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 16, 17, 18, over to a friend's house. And the father was a very successful owner of a large trucking firm. And so he and my dad were talking about investing. And this had to be late 70s, early 80s, when inflation rates, for those of you that aren't aware, were in the double digits. That means like 10, 11, 12%. So the father of my friend discussed that he had put all of his investments in government bonds. But wait for it. These government bonds were paying a return of 12%. And so what does that mean? Well, first of all, it means it's a lot of a different market than it is today. But it also means that he recognized in late 1970s, early 1980s, the fact that the average bond rate hovers historically around 5%. And when he saw a guaranteed return of 12%, he understood that was an amazingly good deal because obviously inflation went down to more normal levels over the next several years, and he was left holding long-term government bonds, paying him a secure 12% a year. So that is the value of understanding what historical returns are and being able to pivot and take advantage of the reversion to the mean concept. So when you see something trading for way undervalued, you want to say, maybe I'll allocate a little more of my money to that. On the flip side, when you see assets that are way overvalued, you may want to say, I'm going to scale back a little bit. And if this sounds really confusing, it doesn't need to be. Because if you set up a diversified asset allocation, then as your asset classes get either over or under your preferred percentages, you can buy or sell, and you will automatically be buying more undervalued assets and selling more overvalued assets.
I love that. And I think it's sometimes it's hard in the moment to bring that kind of perspective that your friend's father had, right? Because at the time, interest rates were a lot higher and people were thinking they're going to keep going higher. That was the talk track, because everyone was worried about inflation, interest rates would keep going up. And then what if you bought at 12? Well, what if it went up to 20, right? Because you don't know where the top is or the bottom is. But like you said, Barb, you know, there is a historical context. You know, interest rates are not going to 100%. Well, maybe in Venezuela, but generally speaking, they're not going to go that high. So, you know, that's a really important thing to keep in context. As we kind of talk about that topic right now, there's a big back and forth going on about inflation. This has been discussed for the last, I don't know, 3 to 6 months. It's been happening prior to that, but people really been talking about it in the last few months. So when we look at the conversation from the interview about that inflation, deflation, stagflation, you know, Barb, I know you have some kind of strong thoughts around that. What are your thoughts on kind of what Dan said and generally the amount of inflation going on right now?
Well, right now, I am staring at the inflation figures, which are different depending on what metric you use. But the broad consumer price index is the one that includes a whole basket of goods and services, including food and energy, which we use today. And that measures how much prices are going up. So what are my thoughts? Well, in May, the inflation rate was 5%. In April, it was 4.2%, which means this basket of goods is increased 5% over its price from May last year. Now, to put that in perspective, 2020, the average inflation rate was 1.2%. And 2019 was 1.8%. And what this means, and I don't need to tell you guys this because you go to the supermarket and you fill your cars up with gas and you recognize, wow, things are getting really expensive really fast. So yes, that does impact your investments as well. And so it's important to be aware of the inflation rate, as well as think about capitalizing if inflation is in fact going to be back for a while. You want to tweak your portfolio maybe a little bit. And I'm not talking an overhaul, but you might want to, say, slip in a commodities fund or put in a REIT or two, a real estate investment trust, because they do well under inflationary situations. So yeah, it's not, you're not dreaming. Inflation is kicking up. And if you think again back to the reversion of the mean average historical inflation rate is typically 2% or a little above 2%. And if it's been in the 1% region for a while, then it might not be unusual to see it go up a little bit higher for a little while.
So are you worried about inflation, Barb?
Kirk, don't ask me if I'm worried. I'm worried about everything. I'm always worried about everything. You should know me by now. My personality is anxiety driven. So there is nothing I'm not worried about. But fortunately, aside from doing yoga, which helps me calm down, and of course, this was probably TMI, but that's again why I believe in diversification, because I cannot control the future. I don't know the future, neither does anyone else. And that's why if you keep a basically diversified portfolio, and I loved what Dan Rasmussen said, which was diversified doesn't mean a total stock market, international stock market fund. It means region-specific funds, maybe a Europe international fund or a developed market or an emerging markets fund, a small cap value fund. They're all varieties of asset classes you might want to broaden out into. And as far as I can tell, that's the best way to protect yourself from inflation, from one asset class going either way, way down or suffering a crash. So yes, I am worried about inflation, also preparing my diversified portfolio and my investments to handle it.
Can I just jump in here real quick to toggle on something Barb said? You know, it's interesting in the inflation numbers she talked about. From a more practical standpoint, you know, when you're running models, what I have found the weaknesses in models in looking at long-term cash flows, whether someone can retire, is that many advisors don't always look seriously at the inflation rate. I usually see it at a very nominal rate. And for years, I've always run all of my long-term scenarios factoring in 2% and then 3.5%. And the clients are always like, whoa, wait, 3.5%, I run out of money quicker. And I've always done that because, again, I'm really stress testing, because I always say at age 85, you can't go back to work. You're sort of committed at that point to the retirement plan. So I say this because even though a lot of people believe the inflation right now is a bit of a blip, you know, as you run your numbers, as you look at your long-term scenario planning, don't be afraid to ever run a scenario with really high inflation. Because listening to Barb's story, seeing where we are today, it does happen. And when it happens fast, and you can't plan for it at that point.
I'm going to kind of take
challenge me on this.
No, I'm going to
have a fight.
I'm going to challenge the inflation conversation. You know, we talked about earlier, one thing you believe your peers do not believe. I'm going to pull mine out of the hat right now, because I think that inflation's not as big of a problem as people think it is. I'll explain why, but I think that most people are worried about inflation. I'm still worried about deflation. And I want to put this in context, because most people are very binary in their thinking. They think you're either, you believe in inflation or deflation. And people look at inflation, they say, oh, you know, is it going to be inflation or deflation? Well, it could be both. And inflation is a complex topic. So you could have both inflation and deflation at the same time, because you have different goods and services that are being measured. Some are more important than others. You know, whether we have inflation, deflation in the prices of a new computer is less relevant if you're not buying a computer. Or if you're not worried about sending your kids to college, the inflation in the rates of college costs probably don't matter to you. However, goods like food or gas for your car are going to be important. So there's so many different types of inflation and deflation out there. I mean, we have not had broad-based wage inflation for the last 20 years. You know, it's kind of bumped up and down right now. We're on a little bit of an upswing, but basically it's been more or less mediocre. It's been stagnation, let's put it that way, for the last 20 years. And so you have to keep in mind that this is not a binary thing. You know, these numbers like the CPI that the government puts out, it's important as a guidepost, but you can't tie everything to that, because a lot of people will argue whether it's a good measure or not. I'm not going to make that argument because it's too complex and, quite frankly, be a little boring for the show. But the way I think about it is this: if you want to just take a simplified perspective, just look at inflation as a simplified number. I think in the short term, Barb's right. We are having inflation, and we will probably in the short term have inflation. But getting back to the reversion to the mean, it's a great point that's been brought up today. Because just like with anything else, I think that inflation numbers are going to have another reversion to the mean. Because for so many reasons, inflation's really not an issue. It's an issue now because the supply chain is mainly broken, or not broken, but damaged because of COVID. So you have things like lumber going up 300%, and oil prices are, I forget what they are today, but they're right at the, actually at the line. I think they're at $70, a little bit over 70. And some people are claiming it's going to go to 100. So you can kind of make all these claims and say, all right, inflation is going to be a problem. But you know, what happens when things go back to normal? I mean, there's a concept that kind of gets bat around once in a while, which is the cure for high prices is high prices. And the cure for low prices is low prices, because an economy works with supply and demand. So if you have high prices, people are going to overproduce. So you have high lumber prices, people are going to cut down as many trees as they can. And now you're going to have an overabundance of supply, which is going to drive the prices back down again, in some ways lower than they were before, because you have to burn off that supply, and then it kind of finds a happy medium. So I'm of the belief that we may experience inflation for the short term, maybe till the end of the year. We'll see how long it takes for things to get fixed. But then after that, I think we're going back to a deflationary or stagnation scenario. So that to me is not a concern. I think the short term it may be, but I don't know. What are your thoughts, Barb?
Well, it brings me to the reality that inflation doesn't hit everyone the same. Like you said, Kirk, if you don't have a kid going to college, it doesn't matter what inflation rate is for college. But everybody eats. So that inflation rate is important. Everyone is not buying a computer. So they're deflating, doesn't matter, because I don't need a new computer. So the inflation rate is personal. That's number one. Where inflation rates are going to go in the future is above my pay grade. I hope you're right, Kirk, because I'm not crazy about inflation. But I think I don't know where they're going to go in the future. I am not as confident as Kirk that they will go back to sub 2%, but they certainly may. And the central bank works very hard. Part of their mission is to keep inflation rates low. And they've been extremely powerful in keeping on top of inflation rates. He is right. Supply chain is a little bit out of whack now, and especially in certain commodities and in certain goods. So what's the takeaway? What do you do? Should you worry about it? Shouldn't you worry about it? Again, it gets back to just being aware, looking what's happening, protecting yourself so that if inflation does get out of whack, you have some investments that can profit from it. And on the other side, one thing we haven't talked about, which is the positive effects of inflation, which are your wages could go up. And because right now there are a lot of jobs that are not being filled, employers are being forced to raise wages. And so once your wages are increased, if inflation goes back down, you're still the lucky worker that has higher wages. So to sum it up, just be aware of what's going on now, what could happen in the future. And other than that, realize that you don't know what's going to happen. So you want to keep diversified in your investing, and you want to be smart in your shopping.
I agree. That's good advice. So as we kind of wrap it up, one final question here, because one of the parts of the interview we talked about kind of managing a crisis. So Megan, how do you kind of manage a crisis?
I'm assuming when the market drops is what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think the lessons apply to anything, but let's just say for the market drop.
You know, I think the thing is markets are doing well today as we're taping this, but I'm already doing a lot of work to get everybody in position for the next time we have an issue. So I'll give you an example. Yesterday, one of my clients who has a very large asset base called a little frantic because he heard on CNBC that they're saying there's going to be a 10% pullback in August, which, you know, my first reaction is it's CNBC. They have no clue what's going on. But I also was like, look, at the end of the day, that's actually a positive for us because it means, you know, our fixed income will be more heavily weighted than our equities and we can trim and we can deploy. And we really should be embracing these moments. So I do a lot of work with clients and thinking about next time the crisis comes, how should we behave? And we also do a lot of work on assessing how we behaved during a crisis. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the last meetings over the last 6 months talking about how my clients behaved in March of 2020. And for the large percentage of them, you know, they behaved as they should from a textbook standpoint. They trimmed fixed income and redeployed back into equities, even though they were watching the markets drop precipitously. And they were rewarded for that. So when I think about crisis, like it's like, you know, the old thing, what is it? In the Chinese language, the word crisis has the word opportunity in it. I see it as an opportunity. And you have to position it as you're not really investing for today. Going back to what he said about trends, you're investing for the long term. And over the long term, the markets will perform.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Barb, what about you? How do you manage a crisis?
Well, if you don't have fancy software to predict future returns, what is a really simple thing to do is look at your portfolio, divide it into two categories, percentage of stocks, percentage of bonds, and look at how much or fixed income. And then look at how much you have invested in each one of those categories. Then project a negative return in the stocks of 30 or 40% and multiply that out by the percent you have invested in the stock market. And then calculate maybe a 1% return or a 2% return in the bonds. Multiply that out by the percent you have invested in the bond market. Add those two up, and that will give you an idea of a worst case scenario loss. And so if we have a really sharp decline in the markets of, say, 30%, even 40%, unless you are all in equities, you're not going to have an overall drop in your portfolio of 30 or 40%. It will be less. And you do that so that you're prepared for the worst. So you know, okay, this is the worst case scenario should the market drop 30 or 40%. And next question is you ask yourself, can I handle this? And if the answer is yes, then you're fine. If the answer is no way, that would totally push me over the edge, then you need to trim back your equities portion of your investments.
Well, as we kind of wrap it up here, Megan, kind of final thoughts on where can people find more about you?
I really thought this was a great interview. This is one of those interviews that you probably could listen to at least two or three times from time to time, just to remind yourself of some of these basic principles. So on that note, you can find me at Forbes.com/Megan Gorman or on Twitter at Megan_E_Gorman. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Thanks for joining us, Megan. Barb, what about you? Final thoughts and where can people find more about you?
So I have just had my Barbara Friedberg personal website updated. So you can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. That's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to all the resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.